Hello, this is David Wilcock, and I'd like to welcome you to our first CD series to support the material that I've already put together in a series of books called Convergence. In this series, we're going to be talking about a wide variety of topics, and there is going to be a central focus on the spiritual process of ascension. The word ascension is basically a term that I'm using in more of a secular context rather than a religious context, particular to any one religion. The term ascension basically means that there appears to be a change happening in the earth at this time. A change that we see both in terms of social events such as politics and the degree of hunger and strife and inequality and war, and also through geophysical events, the earth changes that are going on at this time. Indeed, there are a wide variety of very measurable changes happening not just on the earth, but throughout the entire solar system. When we understand the nature of what's going on, we will see that despite the fact that many people have tried to discount that there's anything different or special about this time that we're in now, we will learn that in fact many ancient prophecies are all coming together and reaching a fruition even now. Since I've raised this point, I want to also make clear to you that these ancient prophecies are not apocalyptic and doom-oriented. That's a common misperception. Many people, for example, choose to look at the information in the Book of Revelation in the New Testament of the Holy Bible and view that information from a decidedly negative context in which basically we're looking at the destruction of the earth and all life on it. And there are also many people who are of the Christian faith who feel that the prophecies in this Bible make it clear to them that they are part of an elect group that will be able to go through this ascension process, and that everyone else who is not following exactly the way they believe is basically not going to be able to make it. If this were the only source of prophecy, and if their interpretations of that prophecy were correct, then perhaps they could honestly feel they were making a reliable decision in feeling that way. However, the case becomes far more interesting when you realize that we have almost every major ancient spiritual tradition talking about the same thing, bringing up the same topic, and leading to the same conclusions. I want you to listen to the music in the background as you're hearing my voice. I have collaborated with Larry Sire, who is a 9-time Grammy Award winner and also a prolific musician in his own right, has designed a series of bass libraries for a program called Giga Studio, and now a series of drum libraries as well, which are redefining the way in which music is being made at the high-end level. I was very honored to have his collaboration on this project. And the music that you're hearing is from some CDs that he made before, as well as new material that we've made specifically for the series itself. Now, the music that you're hearing and how that works into my voice and my message is very clear. I want to be able to present you with information that will reach you on multiple levels, not just the intellectual level, but the level of the heart. Because what we're going to be talking about is a system of physics, a system of information that's based on human consciousness and the human soul, the human spirit. So this information I'm sharing with you is not simply something where you're going to come away from it with new book learning, new understanding that you can say, I know what the earth changes are about. I know that there's a process going on with the earth and that it's not about doom. There's a golden age coming. It's not just to have that knowledge. It's to have an understanding of how you relate to this information. It's very easy for many people to fall into the illusion of what we call ordinary reality. And by ordinary reality, we mean the idea that you're not special, the idea that you are kind of a fluke of the universe, that life happened to evolve on this one planet, and most everywhere else is just barren and empty, and there's no way that there could be extraterrestrial life forms, etc. I don't think that's true. In fact, one of my discoveries that I'm very proud of comes about from having looked at the nature of how matter and energy combine, and how that process, matter and energy interfacing, moves with consciousness. So that consciousness is a fundamental aspect of the interaction of matter and energy. This information was first brought about in the United States on February 2nd, 1966, when a man named Cleve Baxter decided to connect a plant that he had in his office to his polygraph lie detector machine. Originally, he did this because he was expecting to see water come up through the roots and wanted to see if, when he watered the plant, would there be any change on the lie detector, which primarily we're talking about GSR, or galvanic skin response, which has to do with how the plant conducts electricity. Now, if you're with me so far, what you should be seeing in your head right now is that he basically had two connectors, a positive and a negative plate, and he rubber banded them over one of the leaves of the plant and then connected this to a system that measures how much electricity is going through the leaf. Then he wanted to water the plant and see if he would get a rise or a fall in the amount of conductivity as the water went up the plant. Well, to his amazement, he started to notice that the plant had a much more lifelike type of readout on the graph than he ever would have imagined. It was not simply a flat line showing a constant conductivity. There was a very real series of peaks and valleys and so forth, very much indicative of life, indicating that there was an energetic factor to the plant as well as a physical one. Now, at a certain point, he began to contemplate a manner in which he could threaten the well-being of the plant. Basically, what could he do that would cause the plant harm? And you say, wait a minute, why would he want to harm the plant? Well, the idea here is he started to wonder if the plant was able to think and feel. Because the first thing that happened was he had tapped the contact plates with a pen. These were the contact plates for the lie detector. And the plant showed a signal, which didn't seem like it should happen, but the needle on the lie detector suddenly shifted. So when he first thought of actually obtaining a match and burning one of the leaves on the plant's lie detector graph went crazy. It literally went crazy. and it was as soon as he thought of it. So over the years, he replicated this experiment and continued to find other ways to do similar experiments. Now, naturally, the scientific community did not welcome this type of information. We're going to talk more about what he did later because it is so important, and it does factor in on so many different levels. I want to at least lay out the possibility right now, and we're going to come back to this a lot more in the future, that what he discovered was a field of consciousness that connected his mind with the plant in some direct way. Another scientific pioneer that we're going to talk about is Dr. Nikolai Kozarev. Kozarev grew up in the Soviet Union and actually was captured as a scientist and put into one of Stalin's concentration camps and spent a good number of years in a concentration camp. And if you know anything about what that would feel like, it's quite an initiation. It's quite a dark night of the soul. You can't really have hope for much more than just comfort in the mind, because comfort for the body is not really going to be possible. Somebody might say, well, why would there be any value to staying in a concentration camp? Well, the answer is pretty simple, in fact, because when you go through that type of an initiation, it can lead you to turning away from the material world, to realizing that there's no inherent virtue in seeking fulfillment from the pleasures of the flesh, so to speak. Of course, any major spiritual tradition is going to talk about this type of an idea, the notion that true enlightenment doesn't come from an indulgence in the material plane, but rather from seeking the Creator within yourself. So in some senses, if you're going through a lot of hardship in your life right now and wondering what it all means and how it all relates to your cosmic identity, make no mistake, it's the times in your life where you're having the greatest difficulty, the times where you're having the most strife and struggle, that can potentially be the most evocative for you in your learning process. You can learn more about yourself by moving through the initiations and the difficulties than by just having a nice, peaceful, quiet, happy, contemplative life. When you contemplate your own cosmic identity through the experiences of difficulty and pain, you're able to return to a grander vision of the universe. So this is what happened to Dr. Nikolai Kozarev. He basically went through a horrible concentration camp experience. But when he came out of that experience, he had started to notice certain things about the way the universe worked. Apparently, when he was in the concentration camp, he had the opportunity to observe colonies of bacteria that were growing. And he noticed that the bacteria would grow in a spiraling configuration, meaning that he literally saw a flat area where there was bacteria moving in a spiral that would look like a snail shell, where there's bacteria in the spiral shape, but then on either side of that spiral, there's no bacteria growing at all. So he started saying to himself, what could possibly be causing otherwise random little organisms who should be just going wherever they want to fall in line with a specific spiraling pattern? This was his own way to begin an investigation into the same type of thing that Clive Baxter discovered with his lie detector test on the plants. Namely, that there is a field of consciousness, a field of information that works in concert with matter, energy, and biology. Now, there's been a lot of work that's been done on this science, And we're going to talk about that more later, but at this point, we're still kind of getting our feet wet, getting an overview of what this is all about. I would like to suggest the possibility, for now, that this energy field, which the Russians call torsion fields or torsion waves, torsion means twisting, is more important, more fundamental even than electromagnetic energy. Now, if you're aware of the work of Albert Einstein, who's considered to be one of the greatest minds, if not the greatest mind in all of physics, discovering supposedly that the speed of light is the highest speed that you can travel in the universe, and we'll talk about that later. The equation that everybody talks about and nobody seems to understand, E equals mc squared, stands for energy equals mass, that's the m, times the speed of light, that's the c, squared. So energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. Well, all that really says is that everything in the universe seems to be built off of light. Off of energy, mass, speed of light are all interrelated with each other, and they're all part of one unified expression that is electromagnetic energy. So, if there is an energy that's even more basic and more fundamental than electromagnetic energy, then it's wise for us to learn about it and study it. However, the reception for Cleve Baxter's work with the plants on the lie detector test in the West has been very lukewarm. Here he began to get publicity about this work in the very early 1970s, and we're now producing this CD literally 40 years after he first did this research. And there really are not a whole lot more people out there who know about it and actively promote it as part of a unified scientific paradigm. I'd like to read you real briefly something that Deepak Chopra wrote on the back cover for Cleve Baxter's latest book, the first book he wrote by himself, called Primary Perception: Biocommunication with Plants, Living Foods, and Human Cells. On the cover of the book, it says from Deepak, "Cleve Baxter's research has profound implications for humanity and its future evolution." And then on the back, the quote continues, "Wisdom traditions have claimed there is only one ultimate reality that differentiates into all forms and phenomena. This ultimate reality is the root and ground of being, the source that all that exists in the universe, a realm of existence where we are not only connected to each other, but where we are inseparably one. Cleve Baxter's discoveries have created the new scientific paradigm. The understanding of the paradigm is crucial if we are to heal ourselves and our planet. I'm personally grateful and indebted to Cleve for leading the way. Someday, all of humanity will acknowledge their gratitude to this great pioneer." And I just recently was able to meet Deepak and speak with him for a period of about 5 minutes in Puerto Rico. This was last year in December 2004 at the Alliance for the New Humanity Conference. This is a group that is working directly on bringing about world peace and trying to find ways in which we can enable that to happen. So Deepak's been made aware of some of the research that you're hearing about here, and hopefully in time we can have more and more people learn about this new science. It's so much more than what most people have ever dared believe about the way the universe really functions. And it also helps to heal this apparent divide between the spiritual life and the scientific life. I've heard other physicists who are writing about these alternative new sciences write before about the notion that here you have a physicist who works all week in the laboratory trying to prove that God doesn't exist and then goes to church on Sunday and prays to God. And this is really the case. We haven't felt at this point as if science can answer some of these really crucial underlying questions about the universe and about how things operate. And what does it mean to be human, and what does it mean to be a part of this wonderful system that we're in? So I'd like you to think about the fact that love is not simply a philosophical concept. Love is not simply a concept that has to do with the secretion of various hormones in the body like serotonin, endorphins, and oxytocin, as some would assert that you can basically get the same effect as love by eating chocolate or so forth and stimulating these chemicals in your body. What we're really starting to look at is the notion that love is actually a real energy force, that it basically represents, for lack of a better term, a higher vibration of energy. So when we're talking about ascension, this notion that the whole CD series you're now hearing is based off of, we're bringing back in the concept that the universe is fundamentally conscious and alive, that the universe is one. It is my personal belief, and I have some relatively anecdotal data to back this up, but nonetheless there is data, that there are many, many millions of inhabited planets throughout the known universe, and even within this galaxy, there's probably millions of inhabited planets as well. Life is not an exception to the rule. Life is the rule. There was a study that was done by one of the people who co-discovered the DNA molecule, Dr. Crick, where he looked at the dust that you can see between the Earth and the center of the galaxy. And he looked at it on what's called a spectrograph, which basically just analyzes the colors of light that you see from something that you're looking at through your telescope, in the radio wave and in the microwave band and all these other electromagnetic bands of radiation. And what he found out was that the spectrographic signature, as he calls it, of the radiation from the dust in the galaxy has all the same indications as what you would see from living microorganism forms of life. So he feels that he's made a responsible conclusion in stating that over 99% of all the known dust in the galaxy is bacteria. To me, that's pretty astonishing, because what it's saying is that there is a natural life-creating force written in to the basis of creation, to the basis of the cosmos, at its most fundamental level. And this energy that makes life comes about by an intelligent process. It's not simply some accident. There is a grand design. So when we're talking about the idea of ascension, we're talking about the fact that if you've been working on your spiritual growth all this time, what is it that you're growing towards? What is it that you're hoping to attain? Why are you focusing on this? What's the point behind it? And how does this knowledge of spiritual growth tie in with the ancient prophecies? And why are there pyramids on the earth? And what does all of this mean? What does it all mean when you try to take in the scope of the big picture, as it's been called? All these different areas of study that you may have been spending years of your life trying to put together and make some sense out of. How does it relate to you now? How does it relate to your immortal soul, where you are now, and where you're going? Well, if you believe in the notion of reincarnation, then that also raises an interesting question, because if you're supposed to be learning something, if you're supposed to be growing in a certain direction, does that simply mean that you keep reincarnating in another physical body and going through life after life after life, learning the same lessons, repeating the same experiences. I think it's therefore safe to say that most people have the notion of a higher plane of existence, some type of heaven or higher dimension where they will grow into. This kind of place is not a fantasy. In fact, when I was only 5 years old, as some of you may know, and as I also say on the What Is My Purpose CD, I did have an out-of-body experience in which I found myself floating over my own body and was still wearing the same pajamas that I had in bed and was floating down the hallway. And when I got really frightened and snapped back into my body, I felt as if I had failed and that something had gone wrong, because if I hadn't gotten scared, I might have gone somewhere really interesting. I think that somewhere really interesting that I was hoping to get to shows that even at age 5, every human being at some level knows that there is a higher plane, that there is a place of greater harmony, greater light, greater truth, greater peace. I want to raise a really interesting notion. What if that higher place, what if that higher truth could become the whole earth? That's right. What if the entire earth could become a paradise without the hunger, without the war, without the chaos, without the corrupt governments, without people trying to hurt each other, and without all the stress and the strife and the strain and the problems that we see in front of us every day? Is it really possible that this dream of world peace could be attained? And then you ask yourself, what might hold us back from doing that now? And I believe that part of the problem is that for a lot of people, world peace would be boring. Yes, I believe it would be boring, and the reason why I say that is because I think a lot of people live their lives in a certain degree of chaos, and the chaos is part of what sustains them. As you may know, I've done a lot of work with counseling, and I've talked to many, many people about their personal spiritual issues and how they factor into the greater whole of their being and what makes them who they are. So the conflict seems to feed people on a level where they enjoy what has been called excited misery. And my own experience with clients, with talking to people on the one-to-one level about their spiritual evolution, has showed me time and time again that we create chaos and drama for ourselves as a means of filling the silence. So, if it's true that we create our own reality, if it's true that visualization leads to manifestation, then we have to begin the process towards a true world peace and a true new heaven, new earth, by investigating how that space can be created within ourselves, how we can attain that level of integration within our own being. For again, if you look at your own life, you may discover, if you're willing to be honest enough, that you create excitement for yourself. You create drama for yourself. And if things get too quiet, you almost feel like something is wrong because you've gotten so used to things being active. And the classic description of someone like this is a workaholic. They basically can't handle the silence. They can't handle the peace. I remember a long time ago, a cousin of a close friend of mine had said to me that her radio had broken on her car, and it almost made her go crazy to be driving for an hour and a half in the car without the radio on, without there being any music in the background, any kind of distraction. I've also been in people's houses where they can't seem to live without the television on in the background, creating this constant mundane noise that fills the silence. So when I asked this cousin of my friend why she felt such strain from driving without any radio on, she told me that it got her thinking about all the things in her life that were going wrong. And when she actually created that space to think about those things, it caused her a great deal of discomfort. The point is, when you are deliberately seeking distraction, there's probably something there that you're not wanting to look at. There's probably something there that you don't want to face because it's too painful. As you may know, I have my own history of chemical dependency and recovery from chemical dependency. And the details are not really important here because addiction comes in a variety of forms. You can be addicted to shopping, you can be addicted to gambling, you can be addicted to being angry, you can be addicted to your work, you can be addicted to any of a variety of foods or substances, tobacco, caffeine, alcohol, etc. And one of the real crucial ones is you can be addicted to seeking other people's approval and or drama. Because if you don't get the love that you're looking for, most people will settle for some other type of attention that might not be, shall we say, as positive. So, why am I talking about personal growth when I'm talking about a change in the world that's basically a change in the physics of how the world works? Because you are the physics. The physics interfaces with consciousness. And we're going to talk a lot more about that. But again, for now, our focus is to give a well-rounded presentation. Some of you are going to really want to hear just the science. Some of you are going to roll your eyes if I say too much science. So I'm trying to give a well-rounded presentation that will keep everybody happy. Because there is going to be material that we'll get into that's quite specific, quite detailed, that will help to back up all the points that I'm just setting out there now. So I want you to look at it this way. How could anybody disagree with the notion of a better world as being a bad thing? I don't think anybody really could, because wouldn't it be nice if we could have a planet in which we could trust each other, in which we could make eye contact with people walking down the street and be able to smile without feeling like we have to put up guards and defenses and shields, where everybody can be able to open their heart to each other in love and in fellowship and acceptance, even if there are obvious issues that other people have that are dragging them down? It's just nice to be able to open up to someone and look at them from the heart level and make that connection. And what's even more fascinating is that these prophecies of a golden age not only talk about that ability to open the heart like that, but they also talk about enough of a change in the human organism as if to constitute a whole new level of evolution for humanity. So think about that. A whole new level of evolution for humanity. What does it mean for you to be human? Is the question one that can be answered very simply by saying that you come here to work a job, make money, get married, reproduce, and die with honor? Is that the full extent of being human? Do you think that you'll come back and have future lifetimes as a human being, or do you think that this is your one and only chance? This new information that I'm talking about increases the possibility of what you might really be, beyond anything that conventional science has been willing to accept or acknowledge. And yet, it's science that keeps telling us that we don't have the potential that our hearts are telling us we really have. It's science, in many ways, that has become the new religion, the new priesthood, in which the workings of the atom are considered to be so arcane and complicated that you have to go through years and years of college and get an advanced degree to be able to understand the way things are really working. And there are a lot of problems in quantum physics that nobody ever hears about in the public, for the most part, because they're kind of embarrassing. And those problems don't fit in with the model that they're trying to give, which is that atoms are made of particles. The particle model of the atom can be quite literally smashed, if you'll excuse the pun. And what we're left with is an energetic model, more in keeping, again, with what Einstein discovered, that energy is the basis of all matter and reality. And in my books, I talk about some of these anomalies of quantum physics, some of the problems that the scientists have discovered when they look at the atom. And isn't it interesting how all those problems can be explained in a model that doesn't need to make any apologies, doesn't need to use mathematics to cover up any problems, but it all makes sense. It all fits together, and all the observations that we've ever had line up and add up. And again, one of the things that we keep coming back to is the notion that there is no empty space in the universe. There is no such thing as a true vacuum in which nothing exists. That's an important point. You've probably thought that in between the stars, in the space in between the stars, and the space in between the galaxies, that there's nothing there. That's not what the new science is telling us. The new science is basically telling us that the whole entire universe is filled with an energy source that we normally can't see. So one way you could look at it is that this energy exists in a higher dimension. In fact, the model that seems to work the best, which I'm developing with my colleague Dr. Bruce Perret, is that there is a three-dimensional nature to time, not just space. So we have three dimensions of space and three dimensions of time. So think about what three-dimensional time creates as a possibility. Think about how that would change the current notion of time. You may be aware that Albert Einstein, again, used three dimensions of space and one dimension for time because he basically saw time as moving in a straight line. But if you begin to see time as literally a domain of energy, for lack of a better term, energy that is exchanging with space, moving back and forth between space and time, then you're beginning to get into the model of physics advanced by Dewey Larson, or Larsonian physics. Some very interesting things start to happen when you look at this notion of space-time and time-space, in which we live in space-time. And in space-time, you can move around freely in three dimensions of space, but time is stuck. Time, basically, for us, is one-dimensional. It moves in one set, slow direction. But then if you flip over into time-space, you have three dimensions of time that you can play with and move around in, but one dimension of space. So you're basically relatively stuck in space. You can't move around too much in space, but you have total flexibility to move around in time. This apparently is where we're going when we have a dream. There is a notion, esoterically, that our true self, in the soul sense of the term, our soul, exists as a landscape I know that sounds strange, doesn't it? A landscape. Well, a landscape of what? Really, what this means is that when you're going through your dreams, you're interacting with yourself. The environment of the dream is a literal embodiment of your consciousness and the issues that you have to work on in your consciousness. That means that every person you see in the dream, every environment that you see in the dream, every object that you see in the dream, every color that you see in the dream, everything in the dream, no matter what, is a symbolic representation of some aspect of yourself. And there is a landscape in your dream, and with practice, you can actually map out the dream landscape and figure out where things are. Now, I've been doing this myself, and one of the things I can tell you about that is that the same energy in your soul will show up as different forms depending on the dream. So that probably sounds a little complicated. Let me try to say that in a simpler way. Your personality presents you with challenges, issues. Some people would say that you're born with certain astrology that affects the way that you're going to live throughout your life. Other people don't agree with that. Some of my evidence definitely supports the notion that astrology is real. If that's true, if your personality is a representation of issues that you have to work on as a soul, then somewhere there is a nice, distilled, compact version of all those things that you need to work on. It's all contained within one place as a landscape. And this, again, is the landscape of dreams. Some of us will keep on moving through the same small part of the landscape over and over again. We're going to keep wondering why we repeat the same mistakes. Why, when we have a relationship and then we fall out of that relationship, that the next time we get into one, it's the same issues showing up all over again. Why we seem to keep suffering. Why we reach out and want something to change and it seems like it doesn't. These are the fundamental issues that define who we really are as a soul. How we got to be here, why we're here, and where we're going. Right now, as you're hearing this music in the background, let's take a few moments to think about those issues in yourself. What are the real resistance points in your life right now? Where are things not working? Think about that. Did you notice that when you start looking at those things, how quickly you want to make excuses for them? Did you notice that there is a likelihood in your mind that you're going to make light of your issues, that you're going to say, well, it's not really a problem, it's not really an issue, it's not really a resistance? Or if perhaps there's somebody in your life, or was somebody in your life who was being unfair to you and taking advantage of you, perhaps one of your parents, or both of them, had a certain degree of abusiveness in the way that they treated you, that you easily make excuses and say, well, but it's not really that bad. Come on. Honestly, I want you to look at the issues that have been brought in to the spectrum of your life and go beyond that level of denial that wants to hover around at the surface of your mind and say, oh, but it's not a big deal. And take responsibility for the big resistance points in your life. If perhaps, as I've said before in other speeches, you look around in your house and the resistance is that your house is a mess, then maybe that's the big issue. Maybe the issue is, why do you always feel so busy that you never clean up and that everything looks like a disaster? If there's somebody in your life who doesn't respect what you really feel and believe and would probably want to hide or destroy this CD series if they found it in your house, then you might really want to look at what are you getting out of that relationship? What is that person bringing to you? Why do you feel so compelled to continue in that situation? You know, you might be one of the people who gets this CD series who really would need a big change. And the kind of spiritual awakening that you might be able to have when we take in this grand vision of the science involved would make you say, you know, I'm ready to let go of a lot of things, including a relationship that really stopped being right for me years and years ago. And I just haven't been willing to acknowledge that. Don't you think that when I'm making this CD series, there's going to be a lot of people who fall into that category? Naturally, there will be. We're coming into a time in the world in which the energy of consciousness itself is rising in frequency. What does that mean? The energy of consciousness itself is rising in frequency. As I was saying before, there is no such thing as real empty space. All of space is filled with a living energy, a conscious energy. That's what the new science is showing us. That's why Cleve Baxter can set up anything from plants to yogurt, which has living bacteria in it, to chicken eggs, and even right on up to cells that he scraped out of a person's mouth and ran through something called an autoclave in order to bring out the white cells, or the leukocytes as they're called. And in that case, he was able to take those white cells from somebody's mouth and put them inside a tiny, tiny little 1 milliliter test tube, a little bitty test tube, and then put 2 very thin gold wires down inside those cells. Gold wires that go back to, again, the lie detector. And what he discovered was that even up to 300 miles away, if your cells are still alive and they're sitting inside that little test tube with the 2 gold wires going in, if you're 300 miles away from your own living cells and something shocking or upsetting happens to you, at that exact moment, the cells go nuts on the polygraph, 300 miles away. And this is only as far as he was able to do it, so we don't really know how far it could possibly be done. There are other studies similar to this that show that you could be on the other side of the world and it doesn't even matter. It's going to be the same type of energetic communication. Now again, Cleve Baxter's research has attracted the minds of such pioneers as Deepak Chopra. You remember, Deepak said quite clearly, someday all of humanity will acknowledge their gratitude to this great pioneer. So, Cleve Baxter's research is not something that can be shot down and denied because it wasn't done with the right laboratory protocols, it wasn't done scientifically enough. In fact, I have the book here right in front of me, and I can tell you that he found out, Cleve Baxter found out, that the Russians had actually been able to duplicate his results and get very similar results. The same type of things kept happening. The most difficult aspect of the experiment is that you have to find a way to create an emotional shock in someone in order to get this shock reaction in their cells. But these reactions happen regardless of whether the cell or the plant or the egg or the yogurt or whatever living culture you're using is in a lead-lined cage or not. So electromagnetic energy can't get through lead. You know that from the X-ray thing. If X-ray is a very high-level form of electromagnetic energy. And if the dentist wants to X-ray your teeth, because he's going to be doing work in there and wants to make sure that he's not going to have a problem with drilling out a root canal, God forbid you'd have to have that, but let's just take that as a hypothetical, then you know that you're going to wear the lead apron over the parts of your body that the X-rays won't go through. So if you have cells inside a lead-lined cage, a cage that doesn't allow any electromagnetic energy to get through. And you can have somebody 300 miles away and their cells are still going to react if they have a shocking experience. Then clearly we're not dealing with electromagnetic energy. And Deepak is obviously willing to put his name on the line, as have many other reputable scientists, to talk about this new physics. So the knowledge is out there. The problem is that our society doesn't support notions like this because there are a lot of people who stand to have egg on their faces if their theories are proven incorrect. And some might even want to go so far as to say that there's conspiracies in place to hold down our own sense of divinity, because people who know their divinity, people who stand in their truth, cannot be easily manipulated or controlled. And that might be true. But if there are shadowy forces in the world, if there are battles between so-called good and so-called evil going on, there is a very real level in which we want to see that as a projection of our own shadow self. What do I mean by that? Projection basically is like if you have a projector and there's light inside the projector, but then it goes on the wall, and that's where you're seeing the image. The image isn't on the wall. The image comes from the projector. It only appears to be on the wall because that's where the light is landing. All the ancient wisdom traditions pretty much agree on the notion that you as a soul have a consciousness that projects out into your environment. This is what's been called the Law of One, in which all of us are unified as part of one collective organism in totality. The notion of a separate self is one of those concepts from our level of reality that starts to fall away as we go into higher levels of reality. And in fact, what we see happening in the world between nations is a personification of the issues that happen between us as souls in day-to-day life. So that's why the spiritual teachings that I have been given and continue to give to others continuously emphasize the importance of finding the peace in your own life, finding out why you allow yourself to get so wound up over silly, silly little things. Because when I talk to people about their problems, the things that bother them the most are not the worst issues, not war, famine, pestilence, disease, and death, but simple things, little things that shouldn't be that big of a deal. So many times when I look at the lines on someone's hand and I'm trying to find out where the resistance points are in their life, I see that they're worrying about trivial little things. And all those little trivialities just keep stacking up and stacking up. So remember when I was asking you to look at the resistance points in your life? Let's think about that again. And think about how much of that stuff that you worry about isn't really necessary, but you're choosing to emphasize the negative. Now think about the fact that when you feel those strong negative emotions, you're sending out a beacon which can affect your cells, even if the cells are 300 miles away from where you are. One of the weird things that Clive Baxter discovered is that when you urinate, and no, I'm not joking, this is for real, when you urinate, some of the cells that come out in the urine are living, they're still alive. Because he started to notice when he had his plants hooked up to the lie detector that the plants would show sudden changes in their level of shock. And then right after that, he would hear the flushing of the urinal. Well, one of the things that he found out is that plants and yogurt and so forth are all sensitive to other forms of life around them, even microscopic life. So one of his famous experiments was setting up a system in which he would get a brand new plant. This was very important because if the plant has been around you for a while, it becomes attuned to you and it ignores other forms of life. So you have to get a brand new plant, you have to set up this automatic device that I'm about to tell you what it does, and then you have to leave. You have to get at least 10 minutes walking distance away from you, from the laboratory, if not longer. The device took one of the most expendable small forms of marine life, because they only live for about a day anyway, a brine shrimp, and dumped the brine shrimp into boiling water and killing it, of course. And he said in 35 years of his work, he's only had one person ever complain about the ethics of killing brine shrimp, because they're basically used as a form of fish food in aquariums. And he didn't want to do anything larger than that. He wanted to find the most ethical animal that he could use this research with. So anyway, these little bitty brine shrimp, when they are sent to their death by a totally randomized process, meaning that you don't even know when it's going to happen before you set up the experiment, and then you leave the room and wait a given length of time and then come back, the computer tells you when it dumps the brine shrimp into the boiling water, and the printout from the lie detector test tells you when the plant had a shock. And wouldn't you know, time after time, if you follow the protocol correctly, and that's very important, if you follow the protocol correctly, you see the result. And the plant shows the shock responding to the brine shrimp. But again, if you begin watering that plant even one time, if you begin showing that plant any kind of attention, it begins to tune into you somehow, as if there is a consciousness in the plant. And even if you go away, the plant will be less responsive to the death of small microorganisms. There was another thing that he found, which was pretty interesting, where yogurt, the living bacteria in yogurt, would respond to the death of other bacteria nearby. So if you are eating yogurt, and then the yogurt goes into your stomach and starts to be digested, some of those healthy bacteria are dying. I know, it sounds kind of gross, doesn't it? But hear me out, because this is important. The bacteria that are dying in your stomach actually send a signal back to the yogurt, and the yogurt, if you have it hooked up to the lie detector, responds with a shock. So as I was saying, he also discovered that when people urinate, that there's some living cells in there, and if the urinal has a toxic chemical that's designed to break down any living form so as not to create odor, then when he would hear the toilet flush, of course, there would have just been a shock on the plant that otherwise wouldn't be seen. So if you're going to replicate these experiments, you have to do it correctly, which means there can't be people around, the office building has to be empty, there can be no other environment except the plant and whatever is at work that you're going to be sending it to its demise, in this case, the brine shrimp. If you follow that protocol, you'll get the results. But one of the problems is that other scientists don't understand the subtle nature of consciousness and how all this stuff factors in together. So when they try to replicate this experiment, they don't include all the important parts. So again, let's return to this notion. If your cells are responding to you, even when you are 300 miles away, cells separated from your body, still alive, can respond to you, then doesn't it begin to suggest that that energy is going outside of your body? Think about it, right? How could your cells be responding to you from 300 miles away if your consciousness was only contained within your body? What if your consciousness actually broadcasts outside of your own body and begins to bring in energetic influences from its environment as well. What if your consciousness is not just your consciousness? What if the mind is not just what you think, but what other people are thinking? What if the mind of a violent criminal is not just inspired by his own thoughts, but by tapping into a collective energy field that we have? I would like to share with you now some of the work that has come out from a man named John Hagelin, who at one point was running for president, I believe. And the website that this comes from is called permanentpeace.org. Permanentpeace.org. And I'm going to read you, actually, their research summary, because it's so important, I think it's useful that you hear the whole thing. Preventing Terrorism, a scientifically validated approach to prevent terrorism and ensure U.S. security and world peace. Summary of research. During the past 25 years, our approach has been subjected to extensive scientific investigation and repeatedly shown to diffuse acute ethnic, political, and religious tensions, to quell violence and open warfare in war-torn areas such as the Middle East, and to dramatically reduce global terrorism. Many of these applications took the form of carefully controlled experiments, and the findings withstood the strenuous process of anonymous peer review and were published in leading scientific journals. Here are some examples. Reduced war deaths. A day-by-day study of a two-month assembly in Israel showed that on days when the number of participants in the invincible defense technology was high, war deaths in neighboring Lebanon dropped by 76%. Other possible causes, weekends, holidays, weather, etc., were statistically controlled for. This was published in the 1988 version of Journal of Conflict Resolution. These results were subsequently replicated in seven consecutive experiments over a two-year period during the peak of the Lebanon War. The results of these interventions included: war-related fatalities decreased by 71%. War-related injuries fell by 68%. The level of conflict dropped by 48%. Cooperation among antagonists increased by 66%. The likelihood that these combined results were due to chance is less than 1 part in 10 to the 19th power, meaning 10 with 19 zeros after it, making this effect of reducing societal stress in society, and conflict the most rigorously established phenomenon in the history of the social sciences, as given in the Journal of Social Behavior and Personality. So what are these guys doing? They're talking about this approach that they have. They're talking about invincible defense technology. What they're doing is bringing people together and having them go through transcendental meditation, which is basically a meditative process of stilling the mind and seeking a state of inner peace. So that's what's going on here. So by that process alone, you're seeing 71% decrease in the number of people dying in war during the time that they're actually doing this. You're seeing the number of people injured in war dropping by 68%. You're seeing the overall amount of conflict in the war on either side dropping by 48%. And you're seeing the cooperation increasing by 66%. I want to read you a little more of this because I think it's really valuable that you hear this. The global influence on terrorism of three large coherence-creating assemblies. These are people that are meditating together to create coherence. The global influence on terrorism of three large coherence-creating assemblies was studied retrospectively through an analysis of data compiled by the RAND Corporation. The data revealed a 72% reduction in worldwide terrorism during the three assemblies taken together as compared to all other weeks during a period of 2 years. 72% reduction in worldwide terrorism. Think about that. Each assembly had approached or exceeded the participation threshold predicted to create a global influence on peace. That threshold is 7,000 people. So you have to have 7,000 people or more gathered together in order to get this to work. I'll read a little more. The study ruled out the possibility that this reduction in terrorism was due to cycles, trends, or drifts in the measurements used, or to changes in the season. This came out in the Journal of Offender Rehabilitation. The next heading here says, reduced violent crime in Washington. And I'll read some more. A national demonstration project conducted in Washington, D.C. from June 7th to July 30th, 1993, tested the efficacy of an invincible defense technology group for reducing crime and social stress and improving the effectiveness of the government. In this carefully controlled experiment, the Invincible Defense Technology Group increased from 800 people to 4,000 people over a period of 2 months. Although violent crime had been steadily increasing during the first 5 months of the year, soon after the start of the study, violent crime, measured by FBI uniform crime statistics, began decreasing and continued to drop until the end of the experiment, the maximum decrease being 23.6%. After which time it began rising again. The likelihood that this result, the 23.6% drop, could be attributed to a chance variation in the levels of crime was less than 2 parts per billion. The drop in crime could not be attributed to other possible causes, including temperature, precipitation, weekends, and police and community anti-crime activities. The next heading says reduced crime in U.S. cities, and I'll read again. A study of 160 U.S. cities found that increases in the numbers of transcendental meditation participants in these cities over a 7-year period, 1972 to 1978, were followed by reductions in crime rate. Now remember, they said 160 U.S. cities. That's a lot. Over a 7-year period. The study used data from the FBI Uniform Crime Index and controlled for other variables known to affect crime. This came out in Journal of Mind and Behavior, 1988. Next heading says, reduced violent crime. Coherence-creating assemblies in Manila, New Delhi, Puerto Rico, and Washington, D.C. all corresponded with statistically significant declines in violent crime. In these studies, alternative explanations were explored, but could not account for the findings. This was Journal of Mind and Behavior, 1987. So think about the magical power that human consciousness really has, based on what we're just seeing now. We have an energy source that seems to be all over the universe in the new physics that I've written about elsewhere. We can see this energy source passing from a human being enough so that his own cells or her own cells will respond to their emotions from at least 300 miles away. The only way that could work is if your emotions broadcast out to the world. And if I look at this study one more time, look at the big statistic that we have here. A 71% decrease in war fatalities, a 68% decrease in war injuries, a 48% decrease in war conflict, and a 66% increase in cooperation between the people that were fighting. And in Lebanon, 76% fewer people died. So if you can get 7,000 people together and change the whole world's level of crime, think about what that means if each of us begin pursuing inner peace. And think about what would happen if a lot more than 7,000 people worked through their issues and came into a level of healing. Is it possible that if we had, say, 500 million people who had a major spiritual transformation and awakening and became clear about themselves and about what they're here for and where this is going, what could happen to the world? I want you to have that thought in mind as we now head into the second CD in the series. And I'll see you then. Take care.